724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn. Weekdays from 12:30 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Thursday edition of It's Your Turn. Nice day out there. Actually, quite a bit more sunshine than the weather folks had originally predicted for today. Are we complaining about that? I don't think so. No. We see a few wispy clouds, but that's been about it. We're still looking at things to cloud up tonight, and tomorrow looks like a real mess, a really, really cold day. So we enjoy what we have today. That's what you have to do in the fall, right? Especially when you get into November and you get a nice day. You just smile and enjoy. How about yesterday? That, I think that was the nicest day of the autumn, at least since the weather has started to turn. Now, obviously, we had stretches back there in the first half of October, first 3 weeks of October, actually, where, you know, we had temperatures in the 60s, 70s. That's pretty hard to beat. But since the weather began to turn, since the colder air moved in, I think yesterday was the nicest day we've seen. It was absolutely glorious. I was able to be out and about a little bit yesterday afternoon, and the sky was so blue. It was that robin's egg blue. Not a cloud to be seen. And don't you think the foliage was as beautiful yesterday as it's been all year? I think. Open talk to begin the program today, 283-2525 is the number, 283-2525. I do not remember a year where it took this long for the trees to turn. Oh, we saw a little bit of color here and there, but by and large, yesterday was the first day that I thought just shouted out with the color and sunshine. Ordinarily, we see weather like that in early October, right? Here we are in the second week of November already. Very strange. Now, there are a few trees that have lost leaves, but the majority of them are still in fairly good leaf. You know, I wonder if we're still going to have them by Thanksgiving. I don't know. Thanksgiving is 2 weeks from today, in case you haven't checked your calendar. 2 weeks from today, yes, it is. Yes. We have Veterans Day coming up this weekend, and we told you a week or so ago that we had some special programming for Veterans Day. We actually started yesterday when we talked with the Butler County Veteran of the Year. Roy Ramon was with us yesterday. John Cyprian was here yesterday, too, the Director of Veteran Services for Butler County. And we were talking a little bit yesterday about the Korean War. I think with John we were talking about that, John Cyprian. David Widenhofer is a local man who has written a book about the Korean War. Actually, it's a series of stories about local guys who were in Korea. It's called Knee Deep in Kimchi. And we're going to hear that interview with David Widenhofer later on the program today. Korean War, sometimes talked about as the forgotten war. Certainly not forgotten by anybody who was over there in Korea. And you know, the president has been in Korea. Well, he's been in China for the past 2 days, but he was in Korea as part of his 12-day swing through Asia. And I'm sure there are no Korean War veterans who didn't think a little bit about being over there way back when, as they watched the president on TV. Korean War was early 50s. So, you know, that's 60 years ago now. A little more than that, actually. It's back a ways. We'll talk about it with David Widenhofer later on the program today. And we'll have more Veterans Day-themed programming on tomorrow's It's Your Turn program. Obviously, we're not going to be here with It's Your Turn on Veterans Day this year because it falls on a Saturday. But we still thought it appropriate and, quite frankly, even good to do some Veterans Day programming. So we'll continue that today, and we'll continue it tomorrow as well. And any veteran, no matter what conflict or no conflict, you know, there are a lot of people who served in the U.S. military who weren't necessarily in a fighting war. Their contribution just as important, serving overseas or here stateside in a number of capacities. So we salute all of them on Veterans Day. You know, Veterans Day, we salute all veterans. Memorial Day, we salute the veterans who died for our country, died in the service of our country. We remember them. We memorialize them on Memorial Day. But Veterans Day is for all veterans, no matter when or where they served. Veterans Day Parade here in Butler will be on Saturday. We're getting more details on the weather. It's looking to be a little chilly Saturday morning. I hope that doesn't hurt the attendance. Bundle up, put a heavier coat on, grab your mittens, and come downtown to Butler. There are not many communities that have a Veterans Day Parade, unlike Memorial Day, when even small towns, many small towns have a parade, some sort of a program. Not so much on Veterans Day. So the big one will be here in Butler on Saturday morning. Phone number is 283-2525. It's open talk on the first segment of the program today. 283-2525. 283-2525. We were talking, and it was a few days ago. I can't remember whether it was Monday or maybe late last week. We were talking about recycling and the numbers that you see inside your plastic bottles and bottle caps and lids and so on and so forth. And we had several calls from people. One gentleman in particular said that his particular recyclable collector, and I don't remember which company it was, there are several depending on your municipality, but his collector, his recyclable collector, had sent him a letter, as I recall, that said they were only going to take recyclables number one and number two. You know, they have the triangle, and there's a number inside the triangle, okay? Like on the bottom of the plastic bottle or inside the cap. And it was only number one and number two. And he wondered, you know, what about the other numbers and why do they put them on there and so on and so forth. I said I didn't know, but I would do a little bit of digging. And it turns out, I speculated that at different parts of the country, or even in different towns and municipalities, some people would be able to recycle more than others. And that is indeed the case. The most commonly recycled materials are those with the numbers 1 and number 2. They are the types of plastic that are the easiest to recycle. They're readily accepted by most recycling facilities. Plastics that are difficult to recycle or difficult to sell are less commonly accepted. And those are numbers 3 and on up. I think it was up to 7. So that's the situation. Recycling codes number 1 and number 2 are the most widely accepted. Recycling centers have the equipment to process these, and there are plenty of manufacturers willing to buy them. Number one, soft drink bottles, water bottles. Man, there's a gazillion of those, aren't there? Wow. What else? Peanut butter jars, salad dressing, cooking oil, many cleaning products. You'll find a number one inside the recycling symbol. Number one. Number two, a little different type of plastic. Milk jugs, juice jugs, bleach, laundry detergent, shampoo, motor oil, some retail bags and trash bags, some yogurt and butter tubs. Those are all number two. Now, those two types of plastic are recycled into new plastic containers, tote bags, recycled into other products as well. Then there are other numbers. Grocery store bags. Now, I've never seen a number on my grocery store bag. It's number 4, according to this information that I got online. And in some places that can be recycled. Around here there are several stores that will take grocery store bags. You can recycle them. They have big container boxes usually near the front entrance of the store. And that's pretty easy to do. You just gather them up until you have a bunch and drop them off the next time you go, you go shopping. The other numbers are far more difficult to recycle, and there's only a few places where you'll find them. So I was wondering, if they're not able to be recycled, why put a number in there? Well, they're able to be recycled, but not very many places. So I hope that answers the questions that we're talking about with recycling. And if you're a recyclable collector, it's usually the same company that gathers up your garbage, your trash. If they have informed you via letter or otherwise that all they accept are number one and number two, that's not uncommon. It's not uncommon. The other thing that I learned, and I had never heard this before, if you have, a pill bottle, aspirin, vitamin pills, whatever you got, and there'll be different numbers on the bottle and on the lid. If you notice that, I have many, many times. In fact, in most cases. Usually the lid is a higher number, one of those hard-to-recycle numbers, like 4, 5, 6, or 7. Whereas the jar itself, the pill bottle, is usually a 1 or a 2. Recycle the bottle, but not the lid. Throw the lid in the trash. And why would you do that? This part I never heard. If you put the lids, for example, the high numbers in with the other stuff, it just gums up the works. It contaminates the whole thing, the whole process, whenever they're recycling. So I never knew that. So don't put your little lids in with the recycling. Put the pill bottle in there, but not the lid. Throw it in the trash. And that's obviously not going to take up very much space in a landfill anyway. Phone number is 283-2525. It's Open Talk here on the It's Your Turn program today. 283-2525. One of our sponsors on the program today is Hearing Aid Service by Kelly. If you have noticed that you're starting to have problems understanding people, maybe at the dinner table or in conversation in the living room, or maybe you're not hearing the TV as well as you used to, maybe it's time to get your hearing checked. Or maybe someone in your family you've noticed having trouble, your spouse or a parent or something, you want to talk to them and say, listen, get your hearing checked. We would recommend Hearing Aid Service by Kelly, K-E-L-L-I-E, Kelly, for a number of reasons. First of all, it's personalized one-on-one care. Kelly is interested in helping you to hear better. She is definitely not interested in selling you the highest price hearing aid. In fact, you'll save thousands because there's no overhead. She's interested in helping you, and she will take the time. Remember, it's personalized one-on-one service. She'll take the time to make sure that everything is just the way you want it from a hearing standpoint as well as comfort, too. Complimentary consultation will get you started. So many people who have made the change or consulted with Kelly are so very, very happy that they did so. So why not give her a call? That'll get the ball rolling. Call the hearing aid lady. Hearing Aid Service by Kelly. Phone number is 724-756-4327. 724-756-4327. Hearing Aid Service by Kelly. Back with more of the Thursday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR right after this.
Hi, this is Howie Pinckney with Pinckney Capital Management in Portersville. Today, many people need help managing their investments. The investment options available today can be confusing. If you would like to talk to someone for help, why not call me for an appointment? Howie Pinckney at Pinckney Capital Management, 1284 Perry Highway, Portersville, Pennsylvania. My telephone number is 724-368-4224. Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network. Member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor.
Thursday edition of It's Your Turn. It's Open Talk right now. Phone number is 283-2525. Coming up later on the program, we'll be talking with David Widenhofer, a local man, author, who's written a pretty wonderful book about stories of local guys who were in Korea for the Korean War. It's coming up later. Okay, let's get to the people here today. Phone number is 283-2525. Hi there, caller. This is Dave Malarkey. Go right ahead. It's your turn. 283-2525. 283-2525 is our number. 283-2525. Do you still go to the mall? Do you? Around here, Clearview Mall? Maybe. I do. You know, I was never a person that shopped every day or every other day, for that matter. I mean, it's not, I don't go once a week. No. No, you only take a bath once a week, right? Saturday night. No. There are people who, because of time restraints and family restraints, they do most of their shopping, you know, one day a week, maybe Saturday. You can see these people because their shopping carts are jammed full, right? No, that's not me. But by the same token, I'm not going shopping 3 and 4 days a week either. I enjoy going to the mall. I enjoy. Just the other day, one day this week, Monday I think, I was up at Boscoff's, up at Clearview Mall. What a wonderful store! That's the closest thing we've ever had to, you know, like an old Joseph Horn store here in Butler. Wonderful store. Well, I hope we keep them. I'd hate to see them go. Some of them already have, you know. Hi, caller. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn. You're on the air.
Yes. I heard you talking about the medicine bottles being recycled and you couldn't recycle the lids. Well, I just want you to know that all the water bottles and pop bottles that you get, the lids for those can't be recycled either, so people need to know that they should also go in the garbage.
You know, that's a good point, and it just so happens that I've got my water bottle right here beside me, so let me grab the lid, and there's no recycling triangle, and there's no number inside the lid, just the bottle. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I just wanted to...
Well, the most important thing is, because I know some people, that's people in the family, who have tossed those in, too, sometimes leave the lid on, you know, put the whole thing in. They say not to do that. That contaminates the whole process of recycling. I don't know what exactly they do, anyway. Does anybody know? Do they melt them? Is that what, you know, these water bottles, they put them in some kind of... furnace and melt them down? I don't know. And the other question is, what do they do with the labels? Right. Now, my water bottle here has a like a plastic film label on it. Okay, I think that's pretty common. What do they do with that? Does anybody take those labels off? Heck no, that would take you forever. Especially the paper ones that are glued on, right? Can't get those things off. So I don't know. Whenever they get to the recycling place, well, they soak them in big tubs or something. It's interesting. I mean, I'm a recycler. When we first started doing it here in Pennsylvania, I must admit, first of all, I had my doubts that I generated that much recyclable material. It took me about a week to open my eyes on that when I first started putting stuff into the blue bin because I was astonished. So I'm a true believer and have been for many, many years. I don't know how long we've been doing it, 20, 30 years. But I don't understand the whole process. They must melt them down. They have to. Anything I could do, because they turn them into, like, doormats and stuff like that. 283-2525 is the number, 283-2525. Is there a penalty if you don't recycle? Is there a law about that? I don't know. I mean, there might be, but I've never heard of it being enforced. How would you enforce it? Go through somebody's trash? I don't think they do that. I don't know. And some people, don't want to say they're lazy. Really, once you get into the habit of doing it, you don't even think about it. You know, in fact, if you're ever at someone's home where they don't have recycling or where they don't recycle, it sets you back for a second. You know, you have your soda can or whatever, and you say, where's your recycling thing? Yeah, we don't do that. Really? Becomes second nature, really, after just a few days. And it makes you feel good. You know, you're doing your part, however small it may be, for the environment. 283-2525, open talk on this segment of the program. Hi, caller. This is Dave Malarkey. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Hi there. How are you today?
Well, I'm pretty good. Last couple of days have been sunny, a little chilly, but very nice weather for mid-November.
Yes. As far as the recyclable goes, I know in the city everybody has to do it, and I don't know if they enforce it, but if you don't have recycling, per se, as a garbage bill, you have to prove that you are recycling your garbage somewhere else. And that's the way it was when it first started. Now, I don't know if they're still doing that or not.
Well, I know in the city it's mandatory that you, you pay a trash bill because they were having problems. When they let people do that on their own, some people didn't do it. They'd put their trash out with their neighbors or something like that. And that led to all kind of hygiene problems. So,
yes. Well, anyway, I don't know if they enforce it or not, but everybody I know recycles. So, all right, that's all I wanted to tell you. You have a good day.
Thanks. They enforce the, you're not allowed to dump electronics in the trash anymore. And that's been the case here in Pennsylvania for 5 years, probably. I'm astonished how many people don't know that. I was driving to work earlier this week one day, and I came, what street did I come down? Newcastle Street, North Street, down through the West End, and there were two different places that had television sets sitting out on the curb. And of course the trash man didn't pick them up. I'm thinking, what, do these people live under a rock? How could you not have heard that? It's been 5 years since you weren't allowed to put TVs or computers out in the trash. Amazes me. How do these people survive? I don't know. Hi, caller. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn. You're on the air.
Dave.
Yes. Hi. How you doing?
Yeah. As far as the recycled plastic goes, they make artificial lumber out of milk jugs, I believe it is.
That's like the stuff they use for decks and so on, you mean?
Well, they use it for siding. They just... Instead of using boards, instead of using wood, you can buy this stuff. Check up there at Lowe's. They could probably explain it to you better
I've seen it. Yeah, I've seen it. I can't think of what the name of it is, but they use it.
I don't recall.
They use it in outdoor decks, too. You know, it looks like...
Yeah, they use it in all kinds of stuff.
Looks like wood, but it isn't wood, yeah.
No. It's starting to come down in price. I understand that you can get it in different colors. I don't know that. But they used it on the new housing project up there at Slippery Rock. On the top of the... On the side of the building up toward the top. You know, that's what that stuff is.
I saw it for the... I'd heard of it. I wondered, was it a really high-quality product? And then I saw them using it on... what's that program on PBS, Channel 13? This Old House, where they remodel, old homes and so on. And they use it a lot, so obviously it must be a pretty good product.
Well, supposedly it has little to no maintenance.
Yeah, you don't have to paint it or anything. Yeah.
No. So, I don't know. But the construction boys told me that you cut it just like you do anything. You can get it in sheets or boards, and you don't have to reverse the saw blade. It doesn't gum it up. You just cut it and tack it up.
Pretty amazing stuff. And you say they use, you think, milk bottles to make that. Huh?
Well, that's what they said.
Yeah.
You know, but that's been quite a few years, so.
Well,
the first time I came across it.
All you have to do is look at the number of people who buy bottled water these days to realize how much plastic is being consumed, you know, by Americans every day.
Well, the water's contaminated, but the part that they don't tell you, when they put the water in the bottles and the sunlight, like for these events and stuff, the sun hits the bottle, it contaminates the water inside the bottle. So you're still drinking contaminated water.
I never heard that. Well, no lead in it anyway, that's for sure. Well, listen, hey, thanks for your call. Have you used that stuff yourself, that fake wood?
No, but I've picked some out of the dumpster.
Mm-hmm. Well, supposedly it lasts forever. So. Well, thanks, my friend. Good to talk with you today. Thanks for joining us.
Uh-huh.
And happy Veterans Day weekend to you, my friend.
Yeah, Cinder 5 for the Marines.
Amen to that. Yes, sir. Thank you. 283-2525 is the number. Semper Fi. Yeah. Let's go to this line next. Hi there, caller. This is Dave. Hey, thanks for waiting. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Hello, Dave.
Hi.
I was interrupted here just when you were... I'm the guy that called in the other day about the numbers on the bottom of plastic containers.
Oh, yeah. Good to talk to you again.
Well, I appreciate your finding out about it, but somebody that's working here interrupted me, and I wondered if you could say again what you said about numbers on the bottoms.
Well, 1 and 2, which is what your recyclable collector told you, that's the only thing that they'll accept, right? Number 1 or number 2?
Well, the recycler didn't say that. A doctor, an eye doctor who's in charge of recycling in Leechburg said that. But I've never heard from my local recyclers about it.
Well, we had some other calls after we talked to you, so it must have been someone else later who said that. They got a letter or something from their recyclable collector who said number 1 and number 2 is all we'll accept. That is, number 1 is soft drink bottles, water bottles, peanut butter jars, cooking oil. Number 2 is milk jugs, juice jugs, bleach, laundry detergent, motor oil. So you can see right there, those are the you know, sometimes colored plastics, but you can't see through them, you know, like a Clorox jug or whatever. That's number 2. Those are the two easiest types to recycle. When you get into higher numbers, it's possible to recycle them, but not all recyclable plants do it. So in some part, that's the reason they put the number on. That's what I was wondering about when you called earlier. Why, if you can't recycle them, what the heck are you putting a number on there for? Well, in some parts of the country, they do it. Other places, they don't.
Oh, I see.
So that's the deal.
So you'd have to check with your recycler folks to find out.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
You can be pretty safe with number 1 and number 2.
Yeah.
And those, as it turns out, if you think about it, those are the bulkiest, you know.
Yeah.
Water bottles and milk jugs and so on. Some of the other stuff, the higher numbers, that's usually real tiny stuff like a pill bottle lid or something like that. You know?
Right. Yeah, I agree.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, listen, Dave, sorry to ask you to repeat.
No, that's no problem
at
all.
I wanted to know. And,
hey, listen, I want to thank you for bringing up the subject several days ago because it had not occurred to me, and you started raising these questions, and I'm writing notes like crazy because I wanted to find out what the scoop was myself. So I'm glad you raised the subject, my friend.
And I'm glad you found out about it, Dave.
Okay.
Thanks for taking the time.
Sure. So long.
Okay.
We were... I know how we started talking about this. It was the number of straws that Americans throw away every year. Or not every year, every day. 500 million plastic straws every day. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine that? Wow. 500 million plastic straws every day. So anyway, that's what got us on the subject, and I'm glad we did. So it's good. And we celebrate America's Recycling Day one day next week. I forget what day it is. Someday next week. I think we've got a program coming up on that next week. 283-2525 is our number. Open talk here on the It's Your Turn program. Gosh, I guess we're getting up pretty close to 1 o'clock here. We're going to be chatting, as I mentioned earlier on the program, continuing our Veterans Day salute, Veterans Day, Veterans Weekend coming up. And we were talking yesterday when John Cyprian and Roy Ramon were here with us about the Korean War, the forgotten war in many cases. Well, I'll tell you one guy who's not forgotten it. He's David Widenhofer. He's a local man, teacher, educator, and writer. And he has written a wonderful book called Knee Deep in Kimchi. And it's stories of several individuals from this region who served in Korea. And it's pretty wonderful stuff. And, you know, I dare say most of us don't know as much about the Korean War as perhaps some of the other wars, World War II or even Vietnam, a little bit more recent. So stick with us, because coming up in just a couple of moments here, we'll be hearing from David Widenhofer about knee deep in kimchi. One of our sponsors on the It's Your Turn program today here on WISR. Give me just a second here, because I have, not unusual for me, I lost my papers. Here we go. Cummings Candy and Coffee Shop on Main Street in downtown Butler, and two other locations now too. The original shop, of course, is on Main Street. Cummings has been there for a century. Their shop is actually family-owned for a little bit longer than that, 105 years, 106 years. But their location under the red and white awning, that same storefront on North Main Street right in the middle of downtown Butler, 100 years, unbelievable. And you know, when you walk in there, the aromas of the coffee and the chocolate and the peanut brittle right now too, and then the look of the place, you know, the marvelous old mahogany tables, and wonderful place, great atmosphere. But more importantly, good stuff in there and some great gift ideas. Cummings is offering corporate orders of custom gift boxes right now to give to clients or friends, for that matter. I've given them. You can choose from an assortment of chocolate covered potato chips. They are delish. Pretzels, they're unique too. Pretzels, graham crackers, cherry cordials. You can add a half pound bag of Butler's own proprietary blend of coffee, the Main Street Roast. Roasted right there at the Main Street location. That's why you get that great aroma of coffee when you stop inside. If you're interested in corporate orders, custom gift boxes for holiday gifts, call Barry Cummings. Barry Cummings, 287-3287. Three locations now of Cummings: Main Street, also at Butler Memorial Hospital, and the newest Cummings, Cummings West, on Route 68, Evan City Road, right on the outskirts of town. Cummings Candy and Coffee Shop, they're open 7 days a week.
Leave the driving up to us.
The bus.
We're going your way. Getting there starts here. Just hop the bus. Easy and economical. Just hop the bus. No car, no problem. The bus will get you there. 'Cause that's what we do. Hop the bus. Leave the driving up to us.
The bus.
We're going your way.
Welcome back, good friends. Next segment of our It's Your Turn program. We welcome to our studios a local man who's an educator. In fact, he's taught in many different parts of the world, and now author, David J. Widenhofer. David, nice to have you with us. It's great to see you here today.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me.
By the way, Widenhofer, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Exactly.
Okay, because there are a couple of some families, that's a name that you see around here, and there's another pronunciation that some families use. I just want to make sure I was in the right family.
Yeah, Widenhofer's fine.
Okay. David has written a book on the Korean War. He and I talked about, quite a while ago we set up this date, where you called me and let me know about the book, and, you know, would I be interested in an interview, and it took me about 3 seconds to say yes. I enjoy, and I've done many, many programs with veterans on this program, this format here. I have seldom been able to do programs on the Korean War. I've talked with a lot of World War II vets and Persian Gulf, Middle East vets. But just as it's many times termed the Forgotten War, it seems difficult to find
Korean War vets who have a story to tell or who are at that stage of their lives where they feel comfortable telling that story. So I've had limited experience in talking about the Korean War. And when I found out that your book was about seven veterans of the Korean War, I said, oh, absolutely. Please come. Let's talk about this. The book is entitled The Knee Deep in Kimchi, Seven Stories from the Korean War. Only because I have a colleague here at the radio station who once in a while regales me with her exotic recipes, did I even know what kimchi was. Otherwise, I don't know, I might have thought it was swamp grass or something like
right.
that. It's a kind of cabbage or something, isn't it? Cabbage, lettuce, something that's common in Korea?
Well, it's primarily that's what's used. It's a style of cooking.
Ah, okay.
And they take the raw vegetables and add a lot of different spices, and there's usually some sort of seafood as well. And then it is put into a crock and allowed to ferment. It's sort of like Korean sauerkraut, but very spicy.
I guess that's where I had that. I actually had some. Kate got some. I don't know. She whipped it up for me, I think, some recipe she had. But at any rate, when I saw knee deep in kimchi, I said, oh, yeah, I know what I know what he's talking about there. You have chosen to tell the stories of seven Korean War veterans. Are all seven from this, roughly this region, this area?
Yeah, all seven are either originally from Butler County or have lived in Butler County for most of their lives.
Mm-hmm. And is this the first time that you have published a book, or have you done this previously?
No, this was my first, and I didn't intend for it to be a book, actually. It started out when I was sitting in my living room talking with some friends about going back to get my master's in history. And one of my friends, Liz Williams, said, you know, I always wanted to know more about the Korean War. And I thought, you know, this could be a good idea for a master's thesis.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought maybe I could do an oral history on Korean War veterans. And I had a few other ideas. And then when I first semester of my master's, I spoke with Dr. Alan Levy at Slippery Rock, and he really liked the idea of the Korean War. And one of the reasons was he said nothing like that's ever been done here. So he felt like it was wide open. And so then I had to go out and find Korean War veterans, which, as you said, it's you don't always hear, hey, this guy was in the Korean War. You do hear very often this individual was in Vietnam or World War II.
Mm-hmm.
But some of these guys I've known as long as I can remember. Anthony Green, I grew up right down the road from his house, and I never knew until I started this process that he was actually in the Korean War. Mike Spahn was lifelong friends with my father and was in my house several times as I was growing up, and never knew he was in the Korean War.
I want to mention, before we go any further, the other names, and I'll refer to the contents here. John King, you mentioned Anthony Green and Mike Spahn, Ralph Link, Theodore Robert Sankey, Ted Sankey, Joseph, is it Weber?
Weber.
Weber, and Robert Biedenbach. Those right. are the seven individuals that you write about that told you their story, and the stories are told in some depth. I mean, this is not a massive tome; it's not, you know, 500 pages, but you give a chapter to each man, and
yes.
they tell their story in some detail. How did you? What was the methodology that you used? Did you meet with each of these men on a periodic basis, or multiple times, or did that vary?
It varied to some degree. Most of them, it all happened within one face-to-face meeting, and I tape-recorded the conversation. And then I took notes on the tape recording and put that into a narrative form. And then there were some times when I'd have more questions and I'd call them up, and that was usually handled just by the phone. And all of the interviews, with the exception of Jack King, took place within the veterans' homes. With Jack, I interviewed him right in the VFW, where he had at one time been post commander. So it was kind of his flagship there. So,
and your book is just recently published, right, by Meckling?
Right, beginning of April, it was published. And the way this came about was once I had finished my master's thesis, John Craig and David Dixon, who were my advisors at Slippery Rock, they both felt that I should try to get this published. And I was kind of skittish because I didn't write this to be a book. I wrote it to be a master's thesis. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Dixon actually recommended Meckling. And so I held off on that for a couple of years. And then I was sort of, you know, kicked in the rear to look into this, and I took it to Meckling, and they were great, great people to work with.
By the way, I speak of them as if everyone knows what I'm talking about, and many of you listeners, I'm sure, do. This is a local publisher. Meckling is on Route 38, just north of the dam.
Yeah.
Probably about 10 miles north of Butler, and they've published quite a few local books now, and they also, it's a book bindery, I think they do repairs to old books, too.
Yeah, they let me take a tour of the place, and it's amazing some of the stuff they do. They take family Bibles that are well over 100 years old, and they restore them, and it's quite a process.
But to have a local, the expertise locally to publish a book is pretty neat, and they do good work. I've got several Meckling volumes on my bookshelf, and now yours joins them. Knee Deep in Kim Chi is available where? Just so in case there's somebody that has to leave us, maybe they're in the car and just pulling into the supermarket parking lot here. David, where can they find your book?
Well, they could get it on Meckling's website, or they could get it on Amazon.com. Mm-hmm. Those are the two places.
And it's there, because I just looked this morning. It's on Amazon. And there's a nice article about you, too. Let's talk a little bit, before we continue on with the book, about our guest, David J. Widenhofer. I had mentioned earlier on the program today, and I think in the past couple of days as well, a little bit about your life. Even if you had not just published a book, you would be an interesting man to talk to, David. You have been an educator and have taught in several locations, several different countries around the world. Give us a little thumbnail bio of the places where you've taught.
My first teaching experience was in Lesotho in southern Africa. I was with the Peace Corps, and I taught in what was called a junior secondary school, grades 8, 9, and 10. And it was a good experience. It was cut short because I was injured in an accident and had to come back here for surgery. And then I taught locally at St. Mary of the Assumption School in Herman. Mm-hmm. And that was a great experience. And then my wife and I, we got married, and then we went to Ecuador, and we taught in an international school there for 3 years in Guayaquil, Ecuador. And then we went to Kiev, Ukraine for 1 year and taught there as well, and then moved back here.
Ukraine is a former Soviet republic.
Yes.
Now independent, of course, one of the many since the breakup of the Soviet Union. Your wife is Jill?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so it would have been interesting to have been a fly on the wall, you know. Well, Jill, I was thinking about going to Ecuador. What do you think? She's been a willing a partner, I hope, in some of your travels.
Yes. You know, she's very open-minded, likes to see different things, and wanted to travel and see the world. I think, you know, Latin America was a lot more difficult for her than it was for me, because being female and being Caucasian, she kind of stuck out. Mm-hmm. And in the machismo culture, it's a little more difficult.
A different culture. I'm familiar with that. Yeah.
Whereas...
Yeah. Same in Spain, by the way, not okay. as in South America. Yeah.
Whereas in Ukraine, we both blended in perfectly, and the only problems we had there were people coming up and expecting us to speak fluent Ukrainian, which we mm-hmm. didn't, so mm-hmm. That was always fun.
Yeah. You come by your wanderlust naturally because you were born in Puerto Rico, right?
Right, my father was a...
You've been a traveler from the get-go.
Yeah, he was a career military man. So we were stationed in Puerto Rico when I was born, and then my mom is from Canada, the island of Newfoundland, and so, yeah, there's sort of a cosmopolitan background there that's always inspired me to look outwards.
Very much so, yeah. Do you speak Spanish, by the way?
A little bit. I picked up quite a bit when I was there in Ecuador.
Did you end up in South Africa when you were in the Peace Corps by happenstance? Or because I've not talked with too many people who are in the Peace Corps. Do you have any say about where you go? Are you assigned by, you know, some government functionary to South Africa? How did you end up there?
Well, it kind of works both ways. There's you have some choice, but you also have to meet certain qualifications. Certain regions of the world need different things. And for instance, at that time, Eastern Europe was opening up because the Soviet Union had collapsed. Mm-hmm. And what they were looking for more there than anything was small business development people. And Africa, I had a medical background because I was a medic with the Army National Guard for 6 years right here in Butler. And so they thought they could put that to use. And I was originally expecting to go to West Africa. But the first phone call I got from the Peace Corps was somebody working the Lesotho desk. And they said, you know, we think you could do well here. And I said, okay. So that's how I wound up in Lesotho.
Grab your toothbrush and your passport and you're off. Huh?
And hope everything fits in two bags.
Yeah. Did you watch the, well, it's still on, the World Cup is in South Africa right now. And I have to think it's a... well, it is. It's a tremendous coup for not only the nation but the continent, because the world is watching,
right,
and listening to the vuvuzelas.
And it really is. It's of all the places I've been, South Africa is the most physically attractive place I've ever seen. It's just beautiful.
Mm-hmm. It's also heading into the start of winter down there right now. Their seasons are the opposite from ours.
Right, unlike Ecuador, where it was pretty much the same all year round, because we were right on the equator, so didn't see a whole lot of change there.
If you're joining us a few minutes late on It's Your Turn Today, listeners, welcome. Dave Malarkey is my name. Our guest is educator and now author David J. Widenhofer, who's written a book just published by Meckling here locally, Meckling Book Bindery. The book is about the Korean War. Specifically, it's about seven men from this area, this immediate area, who served in Korea. And the title of the book is Knee Deep in Kimchi, Seven Stories from the Korean War. You said your father was career military?
Yes.
Did he ever spend time in Korea? Or?
He was in Korea after the war. He was stationed there. Apparently things weren't that good because he said he didn't see a whole lot outside of the base that he was stationed on. So I've kind of heard about Korea from day one. You know, I remember my dad talking about it, so it never seemed like an odd thing to me to talk about Korea, whereas, you know, there's a lot of people that couldn't find Korea on a map.
Yeah. Still in the news, by the way, and this was the Korean War started, I think, 1950. Do I have the right date?
Yes.
Yeah, June of 1950. The United States, along with several members of the United Nations, came to the aid of South Korea after it was invaded by North Korea, June of 1950. And it lasted 3+ years?
3 years, 1 month, and 2 days.
So into 1953.
Right. Mm. And it, June 25th, this past Friday, was the 60th anniversary of the start of the Korean War. And, you know, you'd mentioned earlier that it's often called the Forgotten War. And I was thinking about that on Friday because I was traveling, and I was several hours sitting in an airport, and I was watching CNN and CNBC and Fox going through their cycle of news. And at least four times they mentioned that it was the one-year anniversary of Michael Jackson's passing. And not once did I hear them say anything about the Korean War. And then when I got home, I looked at two of the local papers, and one mentioned nothing. And the other one, just in their almanac section, there was a one-sentence blurb. Yeah. So it's truly is a forgotten war.
And it's sad because we... the United States suffered, I'm quoting your numbers now, I think 36,000. I didn't take a note on that. I think that's what you wrote. 36,000 casualties in Korea, United States?
Approximately. You know, figures vary. But, yeah, you're looking at well mid-30s.
So just to compare, folks, everyone, well, most people, I think, know what a horrific toll the United States suffered in the Vietnam War. That was around 50,000, just over 50,000 casualties. 36,000 in Korea.
In just 3 years.
Yeah, in just 3 years, a shorter period of time. I didn't know a great deal about Korea and the Korean War. As I said, I've talked to one or two veterans over the years. I did remember one man telling me how cold it was there. He was there, and apparently it was particularly one winter campaign was just frigid beyond belief. And I've seen pictures of, you know, American soldiers from the Korean War, and invariably they're bundled up with the hats with the, you know, earmuffs that come down and big heavy gloves and everything. And I didn't previously think of Korea in that way. I had never, until I read your book, thought about what Korea smelled like.
Mm-hmm.
And since I've been reading your book, I can't get that out of my mind. I'll tell you what I'd like to do, if it's okay with you, David. David J. Widenhofer, I guess. Can we take a break?
Sure.
And then come back and maybe pick out one or two of these stories. I was trying to think of a methodology we could use to get into a little bit more detail. Pick out a couple of the stories and maybe just briefly, you know, tell the story of those men as you detail it in your book, and that'll give people an idea of what you do with the other men, too.
Okay.
We'll do that in just a moment. You're listening to It's Your Turn here on WISR. Great to have you with us today on this edition as we talk with the author, educator, and author David J. Widenhofer, who's from this area himself, by the way. Renfrew, I think?
I grew up out near Hermon.
Near Hermon. We'll continue our conversation with David in just a moment. We'll be right back.
Looking for a way to make your company's benefit package a little more competitive? Here's one that's so easy, more than 130 local organizations and businesses have added it to their programs. Membership in Armco Credit Union. At Armco Credit Union, your employees will have access to the best loan rates and more free banking services, while direct deposit and payroll deduction options make it convenient for both of you. And best of all, it doesn't cost you a thing. Learn more at armcocu.com or by calling 284-2020. Armco Credit Union is an equal opportunity lender and is insured by NCUA.
Did you know that Pennsylvania leads the nation in auto collisions with deer? Not a surprising fact if you live in Butler County. It's obvious that your car and the deer are damaged, but what about you? You may have injured your neck and not know it. An impact of only 8 miles per hour is enough to cause soft tissue damage and mild whiplash, which is not uncommon after striking a deer with your vehicle. If this happens to you, visit Applewood Chiropractic Center today for treatment of acute and chronic whiplash. Applewood Chiropractic Center, Thorn Apple Drive in Butler. Call 724-283-0518.
Folks, you know how close we are to the holidays. Thanksgiving, 2 weeks from today. 2 weeks from today. Have you ordered your bird yet? Let us tell you about Jones Turkey Farm in Cabot. Jones Road in the Cabot area. Their turkeys are so good. Here's why. They're all natural, free-roaming turkeys and chickens. A lot of folks are looking for that these days. All natural, free-roaming turkeys and chickens. Their birds are handled with extreme care. They are specifically fed non-GMO grain. They are preservative-free. They are additive-free. Now, you can buy your turkey frozen. A lot of folks do that. Convenient way to do it. Or you can get it fresh. Get it fresh right before the big holiday meal. Owner Dave Jones stakes his reputation on his turkey being simply the best in western Pennsylvania. No kidding. Here's a phone number. You can call them to order. Or, by the way, you can also visit their website, jonesturkeyfarm.com. The phone number is 724-352-2450. Learn more about Jones Turkey Farm in Cabot. Quite simply, the best. Welcome back, good friends. If you're joining us a little bit late on this segment of It's Your Turn, welcome. Our guest with us here in the studio today is educator former Peace Corps member and author David J. Widenhofer. We're talking about his book, Knee Deep in Kimchi, Seven Stories from the Korean War, stories of local men from this this area who served in Korea. And we're going to talk about, I'm going to take one or two of these gentlemen and talk a little bit more in a little bit more detail. Theodore Robert Sankey is one of the men that you profile. Some of our listeners may know him as Ted Sankey. Some may know him as Bob Sankey. Happens to be an acquaintance of mine. I know him pretty well because we go to the same church.
Okay.
And I've also talked with him. In fact, he's visited with us here on this program to talk a little bit about. I think I had him here one day on the anniversary of D-Day, if my memory serves me correctly, because he had a distinguished military career that covered three conflicts.
Right.
Pretty rare. World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. And in World War II, he was a member of the Army Air Corps Transport Group that flew the paratroopers into Normandy on D-Day, actually the night before D-Day. So we talked a little bit about that. So I know him.
Okay.
And you have a marvelous chapter on Sankey. Tell us a little bit, first of all, about one of the very, very few men, I'm sure, who served in World War II, Korean War, and the Vietnam War. You had to be of a certain age to start with, or you'd never make all three of those conflicts.
Right, and he, I guess he's one of the tallest trees in the forest, when you think about that.
Well put.
He not only served in all three, but he just applied himself so diligently. And it was so easy to write about him because he has so much to offer. He has so many experiences. You know, he was involved in some of the most famous operations of World War II, Operation Husky, D-Day, Market Garden, you know, all of these things. And then between World War II and Korea, he was involved in some of the first atomic testing and what their effects were on military equipment. Mm-hmm. So he has the distinction of also being an atomic veteran, which I'm not sure everybody wants that distinction, but you know, but it's something he did, and it's not anything he expresses any sort of regret about. And then in Korea, he exemplifies that old American Yankee ingenuity, where you see there were several incidents that he ran into where, you know, the solution just didn't exist in the way things were currently set up. So,
by the way, these were not simple problems that Theodore Bob Sankey took care of. You detail, and he was telling you the story, of course, but you detail it in your book. They were in need of, it would have been what we now call a kidney dialysis machine. It was one of the precursors. They didn't have kidney dialysis machines then, but it was a more primitive treatment that they used for, I think it was hemorrhaging kidney, some condition.
Hemorrhagic fever.
Hemorrhagic fever, I'm sorry, thank you. But they didn't have one. I guess they'd ordered one from stateside. And he decided that he was going to get parts from here, there, and everywhere and put one of these machines together. So he got water tanks from the Army and a 25-foot piece of aluminum pipe from the Air Force somewhere, and he did it.
Right, yeah. And
finally, he had everything except something. He had to boil the water to sterilize it, and he ended up getting a cook stove from an old Army mess camp.
Right.
And he put together this equipment, saved four lives before the regular equipment arrived from the U.S.
Sure, and the easy thing would have been to say, you know, we just don't have it. There's nothing we can do. But instead, he, like I said, that old American Yankee ingenuity, he just said, well, we can figure it out. You know, we're smart, we're good, and we're going to do this.
And he did.
And, you know, this is a guy who hitchhiked to Pittsburgh for a couple of years to get his engineering degree. Back and forth, Pittsburgh to Butler to Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh to Butler.
By the way, all the time that he was serving in these far-flung areas, getting an engineering degree and everything else. He was getting married and having a family. I think four children, I think. I kind of lost count through your,
yeah, several
through
children.
Story. But all of this was happening while, and in fact, at one point, his wife and children, I think, went to Japan for a year. They lived
right.
in Japan with him while he was working there. What an incredible career. But then there was Korea, which you, of course, concentrate on. You detail the rest of his military experiences as well. But in Korea, and one of the things he talked about was the smell.
Right.
And this is something I'd never seen before. It's a little indelicate here, listeners, but it's the way it was. War is not pretty. He said there was, in so many places, almost an overpowering and constant smell of human waste.
Right. In Korea at that time, human waste was used as fertilizer. So certain times of the year were worse than others. But, you know, in the spring of the year when they were fertilizing the fields was, of course, the worst time. But it was a constant process. They didn't just put it on in the spring like farmers around here will put mm-hmm. cow manure on in the mm-hmm. spring. It was a continual thing. And they would even take it from Americans' outhouses, you know, where they had latrines set up, and they would complain constantly that the Americans used too much toilet tissue because it didn't break down as quickly as Koreans did.
Gave me a whole new outlook on the rice paddies of Korea, believe me. Not that, as I said before, David, I'm not that terribly well read on Korea, but I will never think of Korea again without thinking. And by the way, he was not the only one who talked about the smell. Several of your other men you interviewed talk about how they can't get that out of their mind.
Yeah, I think the extreme cold weather and the terrible stenches, a couple of things that they agree on across the board, you know, because you do get differences from each story, but that's something that's just a common theme throughout.
Theodore Robert Sankey served as, he was a medical engineer, for lack of a better term. I mean, that had been some of his training, and that's how the Army was utilizing him in Korea. One of the things that he did, and you talk about this in a couple of pages, and he started talking about visiting MASH units, and suddenly I realized, what? This is it. I mean, Hawkeye Pierce, you know, Alan Alda,
right.
the MASH TV series, the movie. This is the war where that took place. They were in Korea. You know, the whole setting that we've, the 4077 that we've seen so many times, that was a MASH unit in Korea. And Theodore, Bob Sankey would go around and visit these things, make sure that they had the medical equipment that they needed. And if they didn't, then he would see that they got it, or in some cases rig it up and get it
yeah.
there himself.
Sometimes fixing it right on site or bringing in a replacement and shipping that other one out to get fixed. But, yeah, you know, he mentioned MASH as well and said, you know, one thing about the show, he thought they very accurately portrayed the extremes in Korean weather, the very hot summers and the incredibly cold winters.
What you saw on MASH, I mean, there were times that the whole gang would be going around in T-shirts, and other shows they'd be all bundled up in winter coats and hats and everything. There was, however, one significant difference. I don't mean to put you on the spot. Mm-hmm. I don't know how recently you've read your chapter on Theodore Robert Sankey, but there was one significant difference that he said he noted from his many visits to MASH units in Korea and what was depicted on the TV series.
Yeah, there was far fewer women in Korea than on the show, or at least that's how he remembers it. You know,
not many hot lips Houlihans over there.
Which may be why the show lasted for 11 years and the war was 3. I don't know.
Yeah, I have the feeling they probably doctored that up a little bit, if you forgive that horrible pun, to ensure the success of the TV series. What else did I wanted to ask you about Theodore Robert Sankey? We mentioned in World War II that he had been involved in some of the most well-known operations, the airdrops in Sicily, Operation Market Garden. That was, I'm sure many of our listeners will have either read the book or seen the film, A Bridge Too Far.
Right.
That was the airdrop at Market Garden. He also talked about, in your book, and I'd never seen this mentioned before, there was another airdrop late in the war. The Allies had actually already crossed the Rhine, and he was involved in the he was on board one of the planes that dropped troopers actually into Germany. It was on the other side of the Rhine, but it was a disastrous airdrop. They lost a tremendous percentage of their planes.
Yeah, there was something happened, whether they were short or far, but the prior to them going in, dropping the paratroopers, the British were supposed to take out all the air, or as many anti-aircraft batteries as possible, and we're not sure if the bombs fell short or went far, but most of them were intact when the paratroopers came in, and so a lot of planes got shot down.
We're talking with educator and author, local author, David J. Widenhofer, who's just published a book. It was this spring, actually. Seven stories from the Korean War, stories, in-depth stories of seven men who served in Korea. Several of them have other military histories as well. But the title of the book is Knee Deep in Kimchi. Knee Deep in Kimchi, Seven Stories from the Korean War. It is available on the Meckling Publishing website and also on Amazon.com. Another story that Theodore Robert Sankey told was, and it was a funny one, and you have a lot of funny stories in here. War is hell, but there's got to be, you got to laugh at the funny stuff or you're not going to make it through.
Right.
Do you remember the story of the missing drugs on the in the MASH units? Let's see if I can remember it now. In the MASH units, of course, you had a significant cache of painkillers.
Right.
Morphine and other narcotic drugs that need, I mean, these were men and women who were getting shot and, you know, and amputations and everything else. You needed these very, very powerful narcotic drugs. But the Koreans in and around the MASH units would steal these drugs. So, and most of the MASH units, they would have them all in one central location in a heavily guarded tent, really heavily guarded tent. It was all locked up and everything like that on pallets in the middle of the tent. But they had one particular MASH unit where they were still ended up missing. And the only place that the narcotics were being stolen from were the cans and the containers on the bottom of the pile of the pallets. The top layers were untouched. And they finally figured out what it was.
Yeah, those drugs were worth quite a bit of money on the black market. And the Koreans were very resourceful people, working with next to nothing. And if they saw an opportunity to capitalize on something like this, they became even more creative. And what they did was, there were some who were working in the mess hall, and they got into a sewer pipe and followed the sewer pipe until they got underneath the tent where the drugs were stored, and then went up in and were stealing it from underneath. And it took them a while to figure it out, but once they did, they put it in a more secure location. Now, what exactly that meant, I don't know, if they had a concrete pad under there, or it was far away from the sewer line, or what it was. But, you know, that's just one example of the extremes and the cunning nature of the people.
The Korean War ended, by the way, never technically and officially declared war by Congress, although obviously it was a war, but officially goes in as the Korean conflict.
Right.
The war was never declared. Back to the U.S., back stateside, and then lo and behold, Vietnam. And Sankey was called upon again by his government, by his country.
Yes, he was. And he went to Vietnam and, you know, worked very diligently trying to help the Vietnamese healthcare system, you know, get their hospitals up to the point where they could be most useful, get the most number of patients in and out, triage and things like that, which required a lot of travel. So he was moving around the country quite a bit. And he plainly states that of all three of the conflicts that he was involved with, Vietnam was the worst. To some degree, you saw this in Korea, where you weren't sure if the enemy was going to be there or not, because there were infiltrators coming in. You know, North Koreans and South Korean, the only difference was a political philosophy. It wasn't racial or ethnic, so you couldn't tell them apart. Whereas in Vietnam, it was a constant thing. There was this constant tension of, you didn't know if there was a landmine up ahead, you didn't know when mortars came in, where they were coming from or who was firing them. You didn't know if the people on the side were going to suddenly disappear because they knew shooting was going to happen, or if they were one of the people who might start shooting at you. So this constant stress and tension.
Bob Sankey, who said that we were always, our heads were on a swivel. You were watching, you know, workers in the paddies, and if as long as they were working hard, you were okay. When you looked and suddenly they had disappeared, that's when you got scared.
Right.
That's when you were worried.
Trouble was coming.
Yeah. Following Vietnam, we're truncating the story here, of course, and this is one of seven stories, folks, that are detailed in David's book. Theodore Bob Sankey had a marvelous career after the first. He's wounded in all three conflicts.
Right.
In World War II, he got a piece of shrapnel when his plane was hit.
By flak,
and lodged in his hip. He was in a Jeep accident in Korea. Both legs were injured. And he broke an arm in Vietnam. And that was another Jeep accident, I think.
Yeah, they hit a mine and flipped their Jeep.
Yeah, flipped the Jeep over, broke an arm.
Right.
So he was wounded in all three
conflicts.
So has he done enough for his country? Well, maybe not. He had a pretty distinguished career in civilian life in the medical field after Vietnam.
Yeah, he went on to work in civilian hospitals for a while, and he was working at the Butler Hospital when their hospital administrator, I don't recall if he resigned or was let go, but he agreed to take on the job on a temporary basis. And it was amazing what he was able to do in the short time that he had the position. He got them the most patient days at any time in their history. He negotiated union contracts without any strikes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've talked to several people at the hospital that were there when this happened, and they all have a great deal of respect for him.
And all of this in a, I mean, he served in that temporary position, a temporary administrator, for a period of just a few months.
Right.
Accomplished a great deal.
And then he went on to be a consultant. He wrote multiple manuals of helping hospitals to implement different procedures, and eventually he did retire. But he was a great interview, not just because of all the things we mentioned, but he's intimidating in the sense when you find out some things about him, you're almost in awe. But when you sit down with him, he's got this excellent dry sense of humor. You really got to be paying attention, but he cracks me up and puts me at ease, and I've really, really enjoyed getting to know him.
Got a no-nonsense look, though.
Oh, yeah. You don't want to mess with him.
He's got that military
stare. He's still a colonel.
He still is. One of seven stories in this really informative and in some ways heartwarming. It certainly provokes a lot of thanks for the service that these men have given to our country and for us. You also have some good pictures in here. All of the men or the families have provided at least a few pictures of you know, them in uniform, and there are pictures of Korea. Your cover photograph, I didn't know when I first picked up the book, but that's a series of bunkers, right?
Yeah, that was actually a slide from Ralph Link, and we were able to get it done on a slide scanner through my wife's uncle, and boy, it turned out great. There, And Meckling did an excellent job when they enlarged it. They brought things out that you couldn't see when you just looked at the slide. Mm-hmm. You know, there's several troops on there that you can see that previously you could not.
Would these have been U.S. bunkers or South Korean bunkers?
That's a U.S. bunker on the, I guess you would call the safe side of the front line. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't be exposed to any kind of direct fire right there. With the exception of if a sniper was able to sneak back through, which he did in one case.
I was trying to remember, was that Green's story, or my stories are running together here. Was that Mike Spawn who was almost hit by the sniper while he was shaving?
That was Ralph Link.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And in fact, that's right. The photograph was taken from almost the exact spot where he was just about hit
right.
while he was shaving. Our guest is David J. Widenhofer. A little bit about the war, because I realize many of our listeners, they've heard of the Korean War, but, you know, what happened. June of 1950, the United States, along with several other member nations of the UN, came to the aid of South Korea after it had been invaded by North Korea. And what happened? We were able to drive the North Koreans quite a ways up the peninsula, and then the Chinese, of course, Korea borders on China. They poured tens of thousands of troops in, and they pushed back down again, well down into what we now know as South Korea. And then it was another push by the Allies to get it back to kind of where the line of demarcation is right now. It was a back-and-forth war with a lot of stalemates, dragged on and on and on, and horrific casualties.
Right, the first year of the war was very dramatic, and, you know, in terms of history, it was the first time the Cold War got hot. And, you know, Truman and all the chiefs of staff sat around and made some quick decisions. And I think it was General Omar Bradley who said, well, we've got to draw the line somewhere, because the Soviets were doing things in Eastern Europe that we didn't intend for them to do, and kind of went against some agreements that we had had previously, and it just seemed like they kept encroaching further and further out. They were destabilizing Western Europe and trying to get communist groups organized there. And there was a lot of paranoia that we had to stop what was happening, or it was just going to keep going. And mm-hmm. so that's where they drew the line. And it was a unique situation because the Soviet Union had withdrawn from the UN, or was boycotting the UN on a temporary basis. So we were able to get all kinds of things done that would have been impossible had the Soviets been able to use their veto. And that's when we got that whole multinational force, and it really was a multinational force. I mean, there were Turks and Colombians and Ethiopians. I mean, there were people from all over the world that got involved there.
Didn't know that. No.
And
of course, we also had the kind of parenthetically here, but it actually just came up in the news on this program because we had the Stanley McChrystal, General Stanley McChrystal was resigned, and David Petraeus was named to take over in Afghanistan, and of course the news media were unable to escape the parallels of Douglas MacArthur being relieved by President Harry Truman. And that came about at this time, mm-hmm. during the Korean War, a conflict of strategy. MacArthur, I think I'm simplifying this, so correct me, David. MacArthur wanted to take on China head on, didn't he? Or wanted to go into China or something like that?
He had a few ideas. He wanted to release all the forces of Chiang Kai-shek and have them invade mainland China while we pushed forth from Korea. Another idea he had was dropping innumerable atomic bombs near the Yalu River, which is the border between Korea and China, and creating just this atomic wasteland that the Chinese nor the Soviets would come through. But the overall strategic thinking at that time was the last thing the United States wanted to do was get involved in a large-scale land war in Asia, because we would just be bogged down with millions of troops, unbelievable amounts of equipment in Western Europe, which we felt was much more important at the time, would be left at the mercy of the Soviets. Mm-hmm. And NATO was just in its infancy at that time and kind of struggling along, and we had Eisenhower over there as an advisor to NATO. And so that was the thinking. And MacArthur, you know, ironically, he kept assuring the Truman administration that the Chinese wouldn't enter the war. And even when they started capturing Chinese prisoners, he said, oh, it's just a few radicals. It's, you know, just crazy volunteers. They're not going to enter the war on any scale. And the Chinese warned again and again, if you get too close to China, we're coming in. And they did. And they came in by the hundreds of thousands.
The only thing, and again, I get this information from your book, David, Knee Deep in Kimchi, the Chinese had a tremendous advantage in manpower. I mean, literally hundreds of thousands of troops at their disposal in a relatively small space. But that was counterbalanced by the U.N. troops. The U.S. and the U.N. troops had far superior firepower and weapons. So that's kind of what led to the stalemate, right? I mean, the Chinese had many, many more soldiers. We had better and more weapons, and it was analogous to World War One, where it was just nobody was moving. It was just killing people, and so eventually, and of course, we had a change of presidencies then too, because President Truman would have been in office when the Korean War started, June of 1950, and Eisenhower came in 52,
right
before the war was over.
Right, and it you know, the person most responsible for turning that Chinese tide back and getting the what we had lost in South Korea back was General Matthew Ridgway. And just the motivation that he brought to the troops and his personal presence on the ground, oftentimes in the line of fire, had a lot to do with it. And he was just a very brilliant military strategist. And once we got to that point where Chinese were ready to negotiate. The negotiations, of course, went on for 2 years. But during that 2 years, we had a very thin line. Our line had very little depth to it. The advantage we had was we could plug those holes with firepower and artillery and air power, especially. Whereas the Chinese, they had tunnel systems that were literally miles deep. I mean, when Eisenhower went over there and General Maxwell Taylor went over, this was in 53, they looked at it and they said, we never faced anything like this in World War II.
These guys were all, Eisenhower, of course, was Supreme Allied Commander. Maxwell Taylor was commander of the 101st Airborne, I believe. Matthew Ridgway was from Pittsburgh.
Right.
Fox Chapel was the commander of the 82nd Airborne. So these were all experienced World War II military guys.
Right.
I think I got those right.
Yeah.
Taylor with the 101st. Maxwell with Ridgway with the 82nd.
Right.
We're talking with educator and author David Widenhofer. I have to take a final break here. I want to talk a little bit about the other men who are profiled in this really marvelous book by local author David Widenhofer. Knee Deep in Kimchi is the name of the book. And we'll be back to wrap up our conversation here on It's Your Turn on WISR in just a few minutes. One of our sponsors on the program today, the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Store in the Greater Butler Mart. You know, the proceeds from the operation of the thrift store help to fund the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank and also their client aid program. So, boy, if you've got stuff that, you know, you're going to be tossing into the trash, you know where that goes. It goes to the landfill. Why not consider donating unwanted or unused items, clothing, shoes, furniture, knickknacks, to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Store? They can put it to good use. It'll be put to good use, and the proceeds will help the needy here locally. They're open Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m., and it's so convenient to drop stuff off. There's tons of free parking right at the door, and drop-off bins are right inside the front door. Greater Butler Mart, Route 8 South. We stand tallest when we stoop to help others. The Society of St. Vincent de Paul in Butler.
That frightening sound is one we hear quite often throughout the day. Our heart quickens and immediately we wonder what happened. A medical emergency can be frightening, every tick of the clock crucial. And that's why Butler Ambulance Service is dedicated to be there with every ounce of care possible. Butler Ambulance Service is within minutes of providing you or a loved one with treatment and transportation. Call 282-9595 to find out more. Butler Ambulance Service is a phone call away from serving you.
What a delight it has been to talk today with a local resident, educator, and author David Widenhofer about his book, his stories of seven local veterans in the Korean War, knee-deep in kimchi. We talked a lot about Theodore Bob Sankey. Other veterans who are profiled include John King, Anthony Green. We've mentioned a few anecdotes of some of these guys. Obviously, we have an hour here. We couldn't give the full story of everyone. Anthony Green, Michael Spahn, was that the gentleman who lived not far from you?
Yes.
Right up
well,
the road?
Anthony Green was right up the road. Mike Spahn's about another three-quarters of a mile.
Also Ralph Link, Joseph Weber, and Robert Andrew Biedenbach, the other veterans who are profiled in this really remarkable book. David, were you able to draw any parallels? Did you notice any common threads after you had interviewed all of these men?
Yeah, one thing I found interesting was six out of the seven veterans that I interviewed were actually in combat. And all six of them, in one form or another, have experienced post-traumatic stress disorder. And it used to be something that was I guess sort of looked down upon, and you know, there's something wrong with that guy, everybody else seems fine. But there was a book written about 10 years ago called The World Within War by Gerald Linderman, and it focuses on World War II veterans. And he found in there that nearly all of them had some form of post-traumatic stress disorder. And the thing I got out of this is a message of hope, because each one of these individuals, they're regular, normal people, yet they found a way to deal with this positively and go on with their lives. John King worked successfully all of his life, worked after he retired, also became post commander of a VFW. Anthony Green has been, worked a successful job all his life, raised a great family, run his own business. Been held leadership roles in his church. Mike Spahn has also run his own business, retired from that, and again holds many leadership roles within his church. Ralph Link not only ran his own business, but then he became a pastor and has spent his life helping other people. Robert Biedenbach is another man who has successfully run his own business and been very successful in life. So the message that I get from all of these guys is, you know, we're just regular guys. We're not heroes, even though I think they are. But you can deal with this stuff and you can go forward. And I think there's a message of hope for other veterans, especially in light of what's happening now in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, these guys are coming home thinking, you know, has anybody ever gone through something like this before? And there's a message of hope here.
One half of the royalties from your book are going to a special place.
Yeah, making this into a book was an odd thing for me, because it was a work of scholarship to begin with for my master's thesis. And then when I was decided to go for the book, I had to go back and talk to the veterans and say, is this okay? Because this isn't what we had agreed on, and they were all okay with that. But then I felt strange about making money off of this. You know, it just didn't seem right. So I thought, somehow, some way, this has got to be a good thing. You know, we got to do something. And so my aunt, Leonie Graham, had talked to me about the VFW's National Home for Children. And she's very involved in the VFW's Lady Auxiliary. And they do excellent things with children who have been orphaned as a result of wars, and they also do a lot with families of veterans who are having difficult times for whatever reasons. So I decided to give half of the royalties to them. So, you know, you're getting a local book by a local author on local guys, and it's a good cause.
Knee Deep in Kimchi by David Wittenhofer is available online at the Meckling website, Meckling Book Bindery.